trio to do this with.
Screenheads. Is that what our viewers are called?
I don't know. We should come up with something.
We
I
need something. Yeah. Meaningers. Or I don't know. We'll figure it out.
Real rebels. R-E-E-L.
Jerry's. They could be our Jerry's because, you know, show me the meaning is supposed to be like show me the money from Jerry Maguire. Just an idea. We'll talk.
We'll get there. And speaking of all the people that listen to this podcast and participate in this lovely community of discussion and appreciation with us, we do want to say a huge shout out to everyone who voted on our poll on Patreon to let us know what they wanted us to cover next. You won. We're doing it today. But if you're watching this live stream, tomorrow we're going to put up another poll for our next episode, so make sure to vote. We're going to have it on our Twitter, which is just at Wisecrack. The Twitter will give you a link to our Patreon. Now, you might be thinking, well, I can't vote because I'm not a Patreon. And to that I say, you can vote. This is a democratic process. One person, one vote, whether or not you are a patron. So please check that out if you're on the live stream right now. It's going to be up tomorrow. You can vote at Wisecrack, and you can determine what we do. You could pick just the stupidest movie, and if you all vote, we have to do it.
Can we even vote if we're a host on the show?
I think that it would be antithetical to democracy if you couldn't.
I got all kinds of burner accounts too, so I'm gonna totally stuff.
Bots. I'm investigating. I will get into the investigation afterwards. But because of the Patreon poll last time, we have decided. They have decided. 1917. So today we're talking about Sam Mendes's 20. Was it officially released in 2019, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so 2019 film, 1917, that takes place on one day in 1917. Before we get really into it, I want to hear our initial thoughts. Ryan, what are your initial thoughts, feelings about 1917?
Oh, boy. So Sam Mendes, one of my favorite filmmakers. American Beauty, I changed my life. Like, I love that. That was like the first script I wrote, read that I really was like, oh, I can make movies one day. And, so I love the fuck out of Sam Mendes, even though Alan Ball wrote the script, but whatever. The movie was directed well. I love him. So I was so psyched about this movie, and especially the idea of him doing another war movie, because I love Jarhead. That's probably my second favorite Sam Mendes movie.
Underrated movie.
Yeah, for real. One of the best. I love war movies in general, so super stoked for this. And then I hear it's a one-take movie. Right, I hear that kind of, but way before, after I'd seen the trailer, and then I'm rewatching the trailer, I'm like, how in the fuck is this going to be a one take movie? You know, like they're in a bunker, they're all over the fucking place, and how is this going to be one take? And I'm like, are they just literally going to be walking from place to place? And I was right. There is a shit ton of walking in this movie. It's unbroken, obviously. And it was, it's clearly a really bold choice in a cool way. We've never seen a war movie before. So I agree with kind of the overarching reviews of this movie are, wow, what a spectacle. And that is basically what my review is. It's like, I separate it into two categories. It's like, this is an amazing achievement in cinema. Just the fact that this exists, it's cool. What it's kind of saying in a way, or not even what it's saying, but just how the aesthetic portrays war. Like, you know, you're with a soldier every moment of a mission, which is something we've never seen. And, it has a really cool cinematic effect. However, I would say that emotionally, this movie kind of left me wanting more. It was a little cold, like in terms of the story, in terms of the characters. I wish there was a lot more character development, which I know is hard to do in a freaking one take. But I wish there was. I wish we got to know our characters more. I wish kind of I felt more when he finally made it, even though, you know, I did feel something, but it just, I don't know. I was left lacking in that department. Like, I don't think it's an amazing emotional experience. Yeah. I think it's an incredible cinematic experience, first and foremost, but that's all you need, really, in my opinion. It would have been great if it was both, but that's kind of my overall feelings on this film. And then in terms
so
of all
much
also just touching on the realism, I like, for a movie that kind of is all about the realism of war, I thought that there was some kind of things where it was too movie-ish. Like, you know, there's a lot of him running away from bullets when he clearly should have been shot. You know, like kind of towards the end when he when the sun's coming up and stuff. Like it like that's something you see in like a James Bond movie. You know, where I thought it was a little out of place in this film. Also, him getting stabbed by the pilot, that was kind of a bizarre way for that one character to go. Spoiler alert. But anyway, overall, great movie. 9 out of 10.
Okay, great. Great. That's good. There's so much for us to unpack later. I'm so excited, making mental notes. Austin, from the land down under, what did you think about 1917? Initial thoughts. Go.
After everything that Ryan said, I'm surprised you gave it a 9 out of 10 still.
Yeah, I okay. 9 out of 10 cinematic achievement, maybe even 10 out of 10. Overall, maybe 7.5.
Okay. Yeah. Form without content is empty. Content without form is fucking chaos. I think this film is form heavy and it's technically proficient and masterful, but content wise I found it a little bit lacking. I think characters are a little bit underdeveloped, and I think the film really rests on us kind of already being emotionally invested in the history, not just of war per se, but also of war films, you know, because it's got that like Saving Private Ryan, go save your brother kind of thing.
So you're agreeing with me.
Yeah, I think so, because it's like laterally referring to cinema. But obviously the choice to make it appear as a single long take is brilliant in a war setting. I don't think that's been done before. Obviously, you've got Birdman and you've got like Victoria, Victoria was a real single take. You've got that horror film with the Olsen. Was it Elizabeth Olsen that was in that horror film? Mm-hmm. I can't remember.
Mary, Marlene, Elizabeth, Sally, and Kara?
No, there was some film. I can't remember what it was. I think it was a horror film that I maybe it wasn't her. Maybe it was somebody else. It was a blonde actress. I can't remember who it was. I'm blanking right now. But so I like that idea. I dig that vibe. But this one just left me feeling just lacking a little bit. I mean, I think I also went in with really high expectations as it being nominated for Best Picture. So I was expecting kind of a typical Academy Award, really kind of emotional, uplifting, sentimental, heroic kind of story. And the weird thing is I actually don't think that we got much of that. Even though I don't like saccharine kind of over-sentimentalized films, I don't think we actually got enough pathos. We didn't get enough passion. We didn't get enough emotion to really latch onto, unless you just kind of impose all of that other stuff because war and the issues of them, kind of like the anxieties that are induced in us because of the time, the ticking clock and things like that. But I don't know. It just didn't fully work for me at the level of content. But obviously, technically, fucking brilliant.
Great. And just quickly to wrap up, I'll say I too love Dunkirk and thought that I'm kind of, I guess, somewhere between y'all and this. I'll try to keep it as brief as possible. Like you said, Austin, you hear so much about this movie leading into it that you can't not have a pretty hefty set of expectations. And of course, the trailer really gives away quite a few of the money shots, so you know a few things are coming and you're kind of waiting for those moments. I enjoyed the experience of being in the theater and seeing it, and I think everyone should go do that. Having time to reflect on it, I kind of think it was fine. As a film, I think that it was a incredible visual spectacle. And, we talked about Deakins last week on the podcast and talking about him again this week, of course, cinematically, and what goes on with the cinematography is stunning and should be awarded. But I was just left wondering what was I supposed to feel? What were the ideas being explored? And does this add anything new to the long history of movies about wars? Maybe there's stuff there. I'm excited to get into it and talk about it a bit more. But something that I can't help but think about is a bit of a spoiler, but we have a video coming out soon on the channel about the Oscars in general and why the Oscars kind of suck. And one of the things that comes up in the video
is this
idea.
Hey, I like the Oscars.
Well, they don't always suck. I mean, I'm going to watch them. But one of the issues is the Oscars have a tendency to reward certain types of films and maybe punish other films. And in a lot of cases, the films we look back on 30 years later that were genre-defining or game-changing weren't even nominated or didn't win. And sometimes we look back at the movies that won and we're like, oh, Driving Miss Daisy. Yeah, 100%. Great. And I think this movie falls into one of those things where it's like Oscar bait. You know, it's like, ooh, the a war. And Sam Mendes.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't call this one an Oscar bait movie. I mean, the one
anything historical, you're doing it.
The one track thing, the one take thing is like a, I think propels it above Oscar bait movie.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. That's fair. I'm being salty, okay? but I liked it a lot. I'm excited to break it down. Before we get into it, though, you've been listening to us talk about our takes. In case you haven't seen it or you saw it a while ago and you forgot, let's run through a summary of the film real quick before we get into it. So, 1917, the film opens with two buddies taking a nap in a field. And before we zoom out, it looks very peaceful. We have Lance Corporal Will Schofield, the handsomer one, and Lance Corporal Blake, the sort of young one that tells funny stories to keep his friends going. One of their captains shows up. Maybe he's a captain, maybe he's a corporal. I don't know all the ranks. And he says, "Wake up, take a friend." He points at his bud and says, "You." He thinks they're going somewhere to maybe get a snack. This kid loves food. They get to command. And we hear that there's a mission they got to go take care of. The Germans seem to be retreating, but they're not retreating. The Germans have set a trap. The second armory commandment, something like that. Commandment, that's not a thing. They're heading into it. His Lance Corporal Blake's brother is there. We got to get this note to them so they stop. It's a very important mission, and they leave immediately. So there you go. We're going down. What do we call it again? The holes, the trenches, the path.
Yes, the trenches.
The trenches. We are in the trenches. It's very intense. It's almost like a walk and talk through New York City, except you're in a trench. the first sort of sage guide we see along the way is the hot priest from Fleabag. He's there. He's kind of funny. He's got jokes and flares. And next thing you know, our guys are on a mission. We're leaving the trench. We're climbing over dead bodies. There's dead horses. We're going around a waterway. And then we end up in a German bunker as our boys go in the German bunker and explore. Once again, one friend looking for food. He's hungry. A rat sets off a bomb. One of our buds, Will, gets buried alive. Blake gets him up, takes him out, thinks he's okay. They find a cute little farm and drink some milk to relax. But just as they're getting hydrated off that cow's teat juice, they see planes fighting. There's a dogfight going on, and the good guys win. They take down a German plane. That plane happens to crash basically right on top of them. Because I guess they don't know how war works, they help the German pilot out and try to get him some water. In the intervening moments, German pilot grabs his knife and stabs the hungry boy to death. We have a last moment where Schofield and Blake are there together looking at a picture of his family, and he cuddles him as he goes into the great beyond. Now we got one guy alone to carry on this mission. Now, right after this happens, he gets picked up by another crew of soldiers, does a little ride along, hears them doing some fun impression work, but eventually has to go it alone. He ends up in a gunfight with a lone German in a tower in a bombed out French town, ends up maybe killing him, also getting shot, falling down, getting a concussion. We can talk later about what actually happens there. He kills him. There's this blackout. He comes to, and bam, flares are going off. There's bombs. He's working his way through this bombed-out town, magically ends up in a basement with a French woman and a baby she found, as one does, gives her all his food, so Hungry Boy was getting held out on the whole time. Finally works his way out of bombed out French town. This part's pretty intense. He probably should have got shot. He didn't. Jumps into a river, does a little raging rapids, goes down a waterfall, but he ends up at the forest he was supposed to be at all along. All of his urgency leads him to sit down and listen to some singing for about 5 minutes.
This is a moment by moment recap, Mike. Jesus.
Yes, we're almost done. My recap thus far has been less than some of the initial thoughts from y'all, so don't get me started. I'm keeping very close time over.
I'm sorry.
Not going to say who.
Me.
We're almost there. Okay, finally, he finds Dr. Strange and lets him read the letter. Benedict Cumberbatch calls it off, but it's basically too late. A bunch of people have already gone out. He's maybe saved 1,000 lives, and at the very end, he finds his dead homie's brother, who's actually a part of the Stark family, but we can get into that later. He gives him the rings, walks over, and Schofield sits against a tree where we first saw him, looks at a picture of his wife and two daughters, who he learns that he's had this whole time. We never heard of them, closes his eyes, and the film ends. Sorry for my long summary.
No. Here's how I would have done the recap. Two soldiers get told to go tell somebody something, and then they walk and they do it. The end.
Okay, so you know what? We'll put both those in this podcast. It'll be a choose your own adventure. You'll hit a button on your phone, yeah, and you'll get one of those. Now, before we get into this, this movie might have made some people feel sick. There's some grotesque violence. It's real. You see a lot of stuff. And last week, I was feeling sick, not because of the movie. I got a little stomach bug, and I had a sick day. And when I was at home, you know when you're sick and you want to like watch something, listen to something? I just did the thing where for an hour, I'm looking around. What should I watch? What should I watch? And I'm wasting time. And I wasted time because I wasn't using Likewise. I don't know if y'all know about Likewise, but it's the only it's this great app. And it's the only app that you need and that I need to discover what to watch or listen to or read next. Now, it's free to use and download, so you could right now look up Likewise, download it. It's free, and it allows you to search across all of your different streaming services to find stuff to watch. And it even has lists that are curated by people with tastes that are like yours, or your friends can make their own list, and it lets you know what's coming to every platform each month. Because sometimes I do the thing where I realize a movie I love was like on Amazon or Netflix the day before it goes off. So it's really cool. You can build community in terms of getting recommendations, and even like celebrities get on there and tell you what they're reading and watching. So that's kind of fun. I'm always like, what is John Legend watching? I want to watch it too. It learns from what you like because technology is smart and it's going to kill us one day, and it makes better recommendations. So it learns what you should do, and the more you use it, the better it gets. And what you could even do, and you don't have to do this, but when you download it, you can add Show Me the Meaning to your list. So your friends know this is a podcast you like, and it can also recommend other podcasts of a similar ilk. Although, I mean, are there others at this level? I don't know. Now, it also supports recommendations for books, podcasts, even restaurants. You ever do that thing where you're like, where should I eat? Likewise is going to tell you. So download Likewise today. You can do it on the App Store. You can do it on the Google Play Store. And what we want you to do as well, go to likewise.com/meaning. It's going to hook you up, okay? So go to likewise.com/meaning, download the app, start using it, add Show Me the Meaning, and never be a dumb idiot like me spending hours scrolling through everything and not making a decision. That said, let's get back to the war-torn fields of northern France. It's time to get into it. Let's break down 1917. Does anyone have anything they wanted to get started with? If not, I got heat to throw, but let's see what the boys are thinking.
You got heat.
I don't at all. I'm just acting tough.
I guess my question to y'all is, in terms of how did the aesthetic work for you? In terms of the one take, the walking, the like, and for one or two, have you guys seen many Gus Van Sant movies?
I've seen quite a few. What were you thinking?
Yeah. I'm thinking, like, he was the filmmaker on my mind during most of this. Like, this movie was like Gus Van Sant's wet dream. You know, it's like he's the master or the... He loves using the just, I'm following somebody tracking shot. Like we're walking behind somebody. And like there's this one scene in, what's it called? Like Paranoid Park, where like you're literally walking behind somebody while they're walking down a trail to a beach. And you see the beach off in the distance. And in my head, I'm like, we're going to walk down that whole fucking beach, or this whole thing, aren't we? We're going to see every step of this. And we do. And it takes several minutes. You know, and I'm kind of like, this is a way to film, you know, a walk, or you could have just cut to him on the beach like a normal movie.
Right.
But like, Van Sant's not interested in that, and neither is Sam Mendes in this movie. But here, there's a purpose. How did it work for y'all?
Well, see, with Van Sant, I think there's a purpose too, because his films are very plotting and contemplative, right? And this one is not. It's not plotting or contemplative. But I think the reason that it's so interesting that we just kind of simply follow them through everything is there are a couple of things. One is we always see the world as they see the world, not through their eyes, but rather we see their response to the world. That's how we see the world that they navigate through. So it creates this really interesting, like, subjective experience. You know, we're not just seeing a battle, we're seeing their fear of the battle or their apprehension of going into this situation. And so we're constantly kind of fed how to respond in a way, which I think heightens the emotional anxiety. And I think that's one of the things that's really beneficial about this type of format, of being so focused on like a kind of subjective view rather than objective view. And then when you add that into the ticking clock, where there's a countdown, you know, I think it takes place over the period of about 8 hours, but the film is like, you know, not 8 hours long, and it's condensed. So you get this compressed, I like how Michael called it Dunkirk, because it kind of plays with the form of time itself, right? And it kind of condenses everything. And when you condense the atrocities of war and all the anxieties of being someone thrown into these impossible situations. And when you condense it into a really short time period, you add that ticking clock, you add the subjective experience, then what you get is this really sort of empathic type of immersive is the word that I guess all the reviews are saying. So we might as well use the word immersive experience into this situation that really heightens the tensions and all of the conflicts and all of the fears and the frustrations and the pain and things like that. Yeah. So I think formally speaking, it was very effective in doing that.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
I really like your point, Austin, about the subjective perspective that you're in while watching the film. And I was thinking throughout, like, in a normal film, we normally have an A plot and some sort of B plot or other side stories. So we have this objective view where we see what's happening in other characters' lives. We know things that our protagonists don't. So we have this God's eye view and we can worry about what's coming or know more than they do. But we only know what they know throughout the entire film. I mean, obviously, yeah, we know how World War I ends. But, that adds to this intensity throughout. And the film is set up.
Yeah,
such
we're learning.
That we know
we're learning with
so
them.
Much. Yeah, we're learning throughout. Exactly, and even the characters themselves, the way they change throughout the story, especially the character Lance Corporal Will Schofield, we really see him change a lot. We see so many emotional sides and responses of this person, such that we even see him at one point go from, you know, I think he's like reciting some sort of poem to a little French baby, and 2 seconds later he's choking out a German guy.
and we see
that like back to back in a way that doesn't break, and I know I really found that valuable. And of course, I think I probably bring this up every third movie we talk about, which is my bad, but I like movies that make me feel a little bit anxious. And in this movie, I caught myself, because of I think the shots and the tracking, putting my hands over my face, kind of like leaning down in my seat a little bit, turning to the side, and I enjoy that from an experiential perspective a lot.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
You had mentioned, Mike, that that he changes a lot. Like, how would you say he changed? Because to me, he obviously goes through the terrible, you know, war. He goes through fucking war. So it's like moment to moment. But it seems like he's been through war. It's just like this is, like we're here with him through this one mission, and it's cool to get every moment of it.
Yeah. Here's what I think. I think the good thing, way to call me out.
I'm not calling you out,
right.
I'm just questioning.
No. Yeah, no, I like it. I'm really complimenting it. I guess what it makes me think of, you ever done that thing where you have a friend, and maybe you hang out with a friend in like normal settings, you get after work drinks or get lunch with them occasionally, and then you go on a weekend trip or you go camping, and you see how this person is maybe when they're cranky in the morning, when they haven't had their coffee, when they get a sunburn, when they drink too much. And it's the same person, but you're having this experience of different sides of them.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like in the film, it was like that. Mm-hmm. I had this condensed experience of, you know, what is Schofield like when he's kind of confident and tired? What is he like when he's scared? What is he like when he's feeling full resolve? Where is his humanity and compassion? And I think, too, even the moment where the whole film, when he kind of talks about not wanting to take his leave, trading in his medal for a bottle of wine, which I think is kind of a sick move.
Yeah.
throughout, it's like, oh, this guy doesn't want to go home because he's just here. He's in it. He doesn't have a family. But, of course, he does. Like, he has a lovely wife and two daughters back home. We get in why he cares so much when he meets the French woman and her baby. Mm. So I guess it's just that he doesn't change, but our perspective of this character changes as we see him react to different moments in different situations.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, do you think that it kind of also opens us up to like a larger idea that he's obviously a single character, but he maybe represents a larger trend of these men who were fighting in these trenches? Like there's no sense in which he is a hero's hero, right? He's mm-hmm. thrown into an impossible situation, and he kind of has to. It's not like he's there like, I am fighting for, you know, queen and country sort of thing, or king and country, whoever it was at that time. It's not like that's what he's doing. He's kind of thrown into an impossible situation. He's making the most of it. But at the same time, I listened to a little bit of some interviews with Mendez, who this film is like loosely based on his grandfather, and then some other people that were talking about this, that there was like this sense that a lot of British young men had that this was going to be an adventure, that we were just going to go and win, right? Like mm-hmm. there was almost like a romanticized adventurous spirit that was tied into going to these fronts rather than it being exclusively we're going to fight. Does that make sense? And I feel like he kind of is thrown into this experience because he's still got that lingering adventurism that he's trying to make this an adventure. But at the same time, what maybe we're introduced to by seeing his reaction to the landscapes is we're more introduced to the horrors and the realities of war as he's thrown into the very front lines. And especially that final sequence where he's running. He's not even in the fucking trench. He's running alongside no man's land, right? And
that scene was good.
It's crazy because it kind of takes your breath away, but it forces you to really kind of come face to face with the intensities of the realities of this situation, that his maybe lingering adventurism and his like, I'm going to make the most of it kind of thing, and I'm going to just drink wine and I don't know if I want to go home sort of thing. I mean, maybe there's something that we're kind of like working through as we're exposed to these different contexts, you know?
Well, I think a question I have for both of y'all then would be, you know, this isn't the first movie about war, nor will it be the last. Like, war films are a genre unto themselves. So something I wonder is, you know, does this movie have anything to say about war? Is it adding something to that long conversation about war that's taken place in cinema? Is Mendez bringing a particular perspective? What did y'all think about that? And how do you situate this movie in terms of the war film as a genre?
I think that kind of like I said at the beginning, like a lot of war movies, because they're not in single takes, you know, they're dealing with the themes of war, the overarching brutality of it, but this is like getting you into the nitty-gritty and literally figuratively into the trenches of war mm-hmm. moment by moment. So I do think that literally the form is the message, the medium is the message, the one take is the message of the movie, which is just like it's more of an experience. It's a ride of a film rather than a intellectual take on war, I think, where it's like people, this is what people went through. It's like a biopic of every person who had to go on a mission like this in war, and you're seeing it through their eyes. So it's more like a ride.
So in your mind, it kind of like gave you that subjective experience of the horrors and intensity of war in a way where it wasn't too Hollywood or cinematic.
You were there. Which you've never seen before. So which I think is a statement, you know, in and of itself.
Yeah. Austin, what do you think?
I mean, I think there are a couple of assumptions that I thought were interesting about war. And, you know, I actually was just messaging Michael off air before this. There's an essay by this philosopher named Frank Ruda on courage that I think is a really interesting thing, because this is one of those themes that has probably been either ignored or maligned, I would say, in a post-20th century women's rights, emergence of feminism kind of world, right? Where courage might be viewed as just this masculine kind of bullshit, like macho, like manly man kind of thing, right? And so Ruda really works through like these different philosophical ideas, really going back to Aristotle about courage as a virtue for Aristotle, mm-hmm. which is the mean, the average between foolhardiness, which is like where you're just crazy and you just run out and you've got your weapon. Think of the machine gun guy in Full Metal Jacket, right? Who's actually a buddy of mine, by the way. But where he's just like, ah, fucking God. You know, he's just killing Charlie, right? And he's like having a great time doing it. Like, that guy's kind of crazy. There's no rational basis. But then there's cowardice on the other end, at the other extreme, which is where you just stay home and you're afraid. But courage for Aristotle is that middle between the two. But it has to be based on like this rational knowledge that you know that you're in the right, or that what you're doing is defending the city for Aristotle, or, you know, defending your family, maybe, as we're oftentimes fed this idea. And Ruta really works through that and kind of problematizes that and says, well, maybe we shouldn't, and I don't want to talk too much about it. If you're interested, you can find the essay. But maybe we can think of virtue in a different way, what he calls, following Wendy Brown, like feminist courage or feminine courage. Can we do that? Can we think about a courage that isn't just like, I'm in the right and I know what is right and I'm just simply defending the right? So you have like your presupposition of what is right, and then you defend it. This film is interesting because I think the one thing it adds is it's not just simply we know what is right and we're just defending what is right, like you get maybe with certain Republican, neoconservative, imperialist rhetoric that's like, well, we are just defending our notions of democracy and freedom and we are in the right and whatever we do is justified because we're defending that presupposed position. This kind of doesn't do that because Schofield in particular, he doesn't really ever talk about how he's like so proud of country and he's there defending the virtues of.
I mean, he trades his medal for a bottle of wine.
Yeah.
He clearly doesn't think it's important. Whereas Blake's like, how could you do that?
Yeah. So it's like, but I think we all three of us would say, but he's still courageous. And maybe, and this actually fits with Ruta's redefinition, that it's a courage that is precisely through and in and alongside an impossible situation that induces anxiety. And that's the type of courage, like the decision that he's made, he's kind of forced into, and then he has to kind of commit himself to the decision to overcome or to survive or to whatever, to do his duty in this instance. And so maybe there's something, you know, maybe in the Kantian sense, you know, that you've got like this moral duty to fulfill. There's something going on here that's an interesting take on war courage, I think.
And that seems to line up with the subjectivity thing we've talked about before, in that in a lot of films we see like the battalion who are all kind of bravely committed to the ideal that they're fighting for in this kind of objective one-way street.
Right, right.
Whereas here we have, for the most part, for at least most of the movie, a singular character reckoning with what it means for him to be courageous, not in winning the war, but in doing one thing and getting one letter to one guy.
Sorry,
go ahead, Ryan.
I totally agree with what you guys are saying, and to just piggyback on it add a little bit to it, like because that is the one little bit of character development in the film, is that, or the big difference between the two friends is that, you know, one of them doesn't care about the medals, you know, and which is a big statement. It's a cool character thing. And the other one does. So it's almost like the credit for, like, why are you doing this? Like you were just saying, like, are you doing it to go brag later? Like, you went to war and, like, have all these stories to tell and all these medals to show? Or are you doing it because it's the right thing to do and that you're there in the moment and, you know, you're just living your life? And a guy in our chat, which I'm somewhat paying attention to, a guy named Cedar and Sound Studios says, as an active duty military with deployments under my belt, I've known both types of people, those who want medals and ribbons and those who could care less. And so that was a really cool character moment.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, that's somebody that was there saying, you know, you have two different kinds of people in war. And then maybe that's kind of what this movie is lightly touching on.
Do you think that the film is making? Yeah. Do you think it's kind of making an assessment, Ryan, that Schofield is more mature because he realizes maybe the silliness of being so kind of invested in the patriotism or the nationalism that the younger character, that Chapman's character, that Blake is in? Yeah.
You keep calling it the patriotism or nationalism. I would just call it, like, to me it's less that. It's more just a simple behavior of I don't know, being amped up about your country. Well, I guess that's nationalism, but I don't know. Like it does. It sounds more nefarious, I think, when you put it that way. But yeah, I'm sorry. Continue though.
No, yeah. I mean, I just wonder if there's almost a sense in which what we're exposed to is that Schofield's character is almost at the end more mature because he first of all, he's not the hungry one, and he doesn't do the stupid thing that gets himself killed. But But I wonder if the maturity is precisely, and let's not be so naive to think that all of our duty-bound activities necessarily come from a pre-existent sense of what is right, and that sometimes we kind of just have to do what we have to do in situations that we maybe wish we weren't in, but we have to do that. And then at the end, I think what's really beautiful is when Schofield pulls out that photo, we then understand what was pushing Schofield forward. And it wasn't country. It wasn't this idea of like, I'm living for higher principles. It was, I'm a dad and I've got a partner. And I am, they wrote a little note that's like, come back to us, right, on the back of the photo. And it's like, that is, even though maybe he's enjoying a little bit of that freedom of being away, he's kind of, you know, trying to, you know, have that moment where he can have that wine and maybe get a sense of adventure and experience. Maybe through this, he even learns, fuck, maybe I need to just get back. And maybe it kind of justifies for him why he was courageous in this anxious situation, you know?
Yeah. I buy that.
And I wonder as well, I don't know if this connects at all, but when we finally get to, and I forget his character's name, so I apologize, but Benedict Cumberbatch's character, who gives that sort of grim line about how, like, this is what war is. If it's not today, it's going to be the next time. And eventually, who wins? Like, the last one standing. It had such like a grim take on what this meant. And that really was what World War I was. And I'm sure someone will correct me if I'll get this wrong. Sorry. But I think it was like the Germans kind of just ran out of money and had to fall back at a certain point. So I don't know. I thought there was an interesting hopelessness in there. Well, and I appreciated that in that moment, there wasn't a lot of virtue given to war overall or even the particularity of their cause, because we didn't really have any discussion of why they were at war, what the stakes of this war were. Mm-hmm. It was just like, we're on one side, they're on the other side. And the highest, you know, the commander we finally get to is just like, well, fuck it. Like, eventually someone's going to be up and someone's going to be down. Until then, this is what it is.
Damn. Yeah, that is grim. I mean, I think here's my ignorance as a high schooler, that I have since, I think, become a little bit more educated. I thought
A high schooler, Austin, I thought you were much older than that.
Yeah, I said that totally wrong. But
you're the smartest 16-year-old alive.
But when I was in high school, I think, from what I remember, I was taught that like World War I started because some archduke was unnecessarily and randomly killed, and it was like an act of terrorism, right? Franz Ferdinand. Like that was the idea, that like out of nowhere, this guy is, and then that's what sets off. Then these people start fighting these people, and then alliances are formed. And it wasn't until many, many years later where I was actually like, oh, actually, the tensions were brewing for decades, if not centuries. A lot of people refer to this as the capitalist war, the imperialist war, that what you have are these warring imperial capitalist states that are fighting over economic interests and economic territories. And so I didn't really understand the rationality behind this war. And so it was really interesting for me because the film is called 1917. And immediately when I think of the year 1917, I don't think of a British trench war. I think of the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, that's my bias. Okay. That's my... So I'm thinking 1917.
Nerd.
Yeah, right? But so I'm thinking like, what is this going to... And then I find out that it has nothing to do with that whatsoever at all. And so it was really interesting for me to kind of get this introduction into a war story that was, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's, in a lot of ways, I've been reading a lot about World War I too, because it's kind of inspired me to kind of like rethink things and kind of consider things. But it kind of just added these different layers to what I understand about World War I based on what I think is a really naive way that the history books and my history classes taught me what World War I was about, which had like no real rationality. But no, there is a real rationality here. We just oftentimes don't understand what that rationality is. And then this film doesn't really spend too much time exploring that explicitly, but it kind of just adds other layers at like an affective and emotional and a personal and individual level. But I don't know. That's kind of just ranty, but there's just some thoughts.
Yeah, well, so I have another question for you too. So I was reading a piece today. It was really good. I'm going to make sure I quote the piece so I'm not acting like I'm smart on my own. But a film critic named Adam Naiman wrote a piece about 1917 for The Ringer, in which he was kind of posing like, is this movie really good? And kind of getting into the style and substance question that you brought up earlier, Austin. And he quoted an interview with Truffaut from the 70s where Truffaut said something to the effect of, every film about war ends up being pro-war. and posing this idea that it's kind of impossible to make a film that isn't somehow pro-war.
I thought you were going to say the opposite, that every film about war is anti-war, because that's
what
it sounds
like. That's why it, that's why it surprised me.
What do you think about
that? So
Line?
He brought that up in the piece, in this Naaman piece I'm discussing. He brought that up in an interesting way, and he brought up how in The Thin Red Line, all these shots and reflections on nature kind of showed the indifference of the natural world to all of our squabbling anyway, so kind of undercut war in that way.
I think war is viewed as being like a destruction of the world that is indifferent that we should be embracing and attest more to, and that war is precisely technology. I mean, famously, Malick is a Heidegger scholar. He actually translated a Heidegger text. So the beauty and the romance and poetry of nature and shit like that that comes out of Heidegger's philosophy, who, by the way, was a fascist, so everybody needs to understand that. But coming out of his philosophy is something that Malick is kind of drawing from. And so war then is a destruction of that beauty and a destruction of that, right?
I probably quoted that piece wrong. But is there anything to this Truffaut idea that by making films about war in this way, by shooting them beautifully, by always having a protagonist that somehow, whether it's implicit or explicit, is on the good side or the side we're on or whatever? I mean, is there something inherently pro-war about making a war movie? I'm not saying I think this. I'm just asking the question.
Here's what I feel like. Maybe I'm stretching, but he's getting at in his thing is that in the quote is that war looks cool on film, and that if you're making a war movie, even if you're trying to make an anti-war message, there's some kid at home going, "Oh, yeah. I want to go shoot guns on the battlefield." Maybe that's kind of the gist.
Yeah, so if Truffaut is alive now, I don't think he is. If he was alive now, no, he would not be like, stop playing video games. They make you want to steal cars from people.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah. Yeah, just interesting. So what other, and well, we're kind of sort of slowly getting near our final bunker of the day, but what other thoughts did y'all have or things you wanted to discuss about this movie? Things that are in your heart just wanting to get out?
Little nitpicky thing again about the kind of
pick it
movie part that wasn't that realistic. When he's doing that whole, when he's having that moment with that baby, it's like, dude, you got a whole army to save. Why are you sitting there looking at a baby underground? You know, like in my mind, I was like, the tension was high and he wasn't being nearly as urgent as I wanted him to be in that moment.
Well, and he doesn't get there in time, does he? So maybe he shouldn't have stopped and chatted with the fucking baby and the French woman. And
the whole the whole first line got fucked.
Yeah, that was just a little much that, like, though, I don't know. That was the one point where I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot I'm watching a movie. And movie stuff has to happen. And in the war movie, the sort of soldier dragging his ass with blood on his head has to find the, like, French maiden with the baby who just needs milk and knows a few words and can say trees in English, and you'll figure it out. And I was like, okay, come on.
Let me very slowly open my canteen and give you milk, you know? Like,
yes,
hello.
Smell it first. So you don't get to smell my milk. You live in this bunker. You're drinking the milk. But just agreeing with that nitpick point there. Did anyone find, and this is a very shallow point, did anyone find the use of, well, I'll start with this. I think having both of our protagonists be actors who, the lead obviously played Schofield. I've never seen him before. And then I didn't realize until a day after I saw the movie that Lance Corporal Blake was played by one of the boy kings from Game of Thrones. But I liked that those were largely actors that we don't know, so we weren't distracted, and it added to the realness of it. Were you all distracted by the high-level cameos that popped up, like, every 25 minutes?
Well, the Cumberbatch one was egregious, because it's like, that guy didn't need to be a famous movie star, and they put him in the trailer like he's a big part of the movie, you know, and he's in one scene.
Yeah, and we have, you know, Colin Firth up top as well, who's in it for, 15 to 23 seconds.
Yeah, like, I don't know. That was weird. So, yeah, I kind of agree that they shouldn't have done that, especially if you're going for realism, you know?
Yeah, I mean, love Andrew Scott. I have a huge man crush on him. Oh, my fuck. Ever since I saw him in that Black Mirror episode, which was, the last season, but episode 2, the one where it's like it's like the Facebooky one with all, yeah, that one. I was like, who the fuck is this guy? And then he's in Fleabag, and I'm like, oh fuck. And then I remembered that he's Moriarty from Sherlock, and I'm like, oh fuck. So like that one I'm okay with. Put him in everything in my mind. He's like my favorite actor at the moment. So that was cool with me. You also got Mark Strong in there, right? Uh-huh. Colin Firth is in there. So
I mean, we had Rob Stark.
Rob Stark.
Oh, that's the I forget the actor's name. The guy who played Rob Stark in Game of Thrones.
Turns out to be Blake's brother.
I was distracted when I realized the two Blake brothers are on other sides of it. It was just a little much. I'm going to say that we had a sort of, I feel like we're all kind of a little underwhelmed.
Like with A Serious Man, we didn't spend so much time criticizing, right? And maybe even with Parasite, but with this one, I feel like. Do you think that part of our criticisms come from like the expectations that we had going into this film?
No, I mean, I can separate my expectations. I mean, it certainly didn't meet my expectations, but once I kind of was into the movie, for one, that opening walk and talk was great. Like that was, I was like, all right, I'm on for this ride. You know, it was just after a long period of the mission where I kind of was checking my watch being like, okay, I don't know if I'm as on board with this as I want it to be. So no, I think that it was in the form or in the experience itself, not the expectations for me at least.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're asking, Austin, is a really good question. And I think it's something we're only going to know once time has passed. And by that, I mean, it's the sort
on
of
the
movie
other side.
That's so, yeah. Listen, when we're dead, we'll know. You know, it's such a, and I mean this in not a pejorative way, there's a lot of spectacle involved in this film. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's involved in how it's shot, the experience of being there. I wonder if in a year or two it's a movie we'd want to rewatch, or a movie that with repeat viewings over the years is going to stick with us.
It's one of those movies that's going to be talked about for a long time, I think, because it's just going to be that example of, you know, one of those great war movies that is different and unique. And so when people mm-hmm. are recommending war movies, they're going to recommend, oh yeah, also 1917, that's pretty cool, different movie.
Okay, so when we think about Saving Private Ryan, what do we think of? We think of when
awesome
they,
hell yeah, love well, yeah, it but, fuck yeah but, Spielberg rock
yeah but what we talk about specifically is when they get to Normandy, and it's that beach mm-hmm. scene that is just
that's
fucking
iconic.
Visceral and crazy, right? Yeah. When we think of Thin Red Line, what do we think of? We think of
boring.
We think of the poetic musings and things like that. When we think of Band of Brothers, what do we think about? We think of it as being a fucking
cool.
Band of Brothers, bros, you know, protecting each other. And what are we going to think about when we think about this film? I think we're not going to think about the story. We're not going to think about like valor and courage and bravery. We're going to think about the technical proficiency, and we're going to think about Roger Deakins, which to me is, I'm not sure that's a bad thing, but I'm not sure that is something that will place this film into the upper echelon of war films that we will remember. I think it'll be one of those ones where people are talking about war films, and then someone who's a, you know, cinephile will be like, oh, remember 1917, and then they'll start talking about the technical proficiency of it.
Yeah, but I think it is a must-see. I think that for anyone that's into war movies,
yes,
like this is a movie
agree.
You gotta see, and that alone makes it worth talking about for years. But yeah, in terms of the best, like my favorite war movie is Deer Hunter. You know, to me that's like the whole package. You know, you're in the trenches, but you're also before and after war. And so yeah, that does it for me. But each war movie has their own flavor. Saving Private Ryan is about the mission. You know, Band of Brothers is about the epic mission. You know, and the camaraderie. And this movie is about the gritty in the trenches experience of like the moment to moment. I have no idea what's around that corner. I don't know if I'm going to get shot. I've seen so many people and my friends get shot, you know, and it's about that feeling. And that is, I don't think in any other movie that I can think of as much as this movie.
Well, I think we're going to transition into a different segment of the podcast, but I think we could all agree on two things. One, everyone should go see this movie. We agreed on that.
Totally.
And two, the greatest war movie of all time is Attack of the Clones. So now that we've said those two truths, I don't believe that. I'm kidding. But please, all of you, I know we have some people that have been participating in the chat. I've only looked a couple times, but know that we're there. We see you. We love it. Shouts to Justin, who I saw there, and the person that was telling everyone about Jesus. You do what you got to do where you do it, I guess.
Don't shout out to that guy. You're encouraging
him. I'm not saying their name. Although their name was inconsistent with their message, but we'll get into this off air. But your thoughts, matter a whole lot. So we want to hear them. If you've seen 1917, if you're about to see it, give us a call and let us know. So you can call us at 1-213-534-8807. Or if you're uncomfortable with your own voice and you don't want us to hear it, that's fine. Movies@wisecrack.co. No M there. Movies@wisecrack.co. And we have some good... Oh, go ahead, Ryan.
I was just going to say that you know, like usually the ones we read on air will just take a snippet or the, like, you know, the key part. But even if you write a really long novel, we read that shit. So keep them coming. Some of you guys write awesome, well-researched, well-thought-out things on what we put out, and so we appreciate it.
Hell yes. And I think, yeah, for anyone who's ever written or called and we haven't shouted it out, we've looked at it. It's been awesome. There's just only so many times that we can cram in here.
Right,
so please keep calling, keep writing. We seriously love it. And I think we can all agree, as the third thing we all agree on today, I think we're consistently impressed by how thoughtful and smart and fun everyone who listens to this podcast is. So please 100%. Keep bugging us. And y'all had some thoughts about A Serious Man. So let's get into a couple of those. And there's one in particular that really dug something that Austin got into. So this is from, I hope I say your name right. If not, I'm sorry. I'll punch myself in the leg later. Cyprian. So they enjoyed the discussion and they said this. Let's see. I enjoyed a lot of your discussion about trying to link the beginning scene of the movie with the rest of the story. But I believe that is kind of the point. They are not actually related, as none of the explanations given to Larry Gopnik are fully related to his predicament. To borrow Austin, that's Hughes, terminology of Lacan, of which I am totally not in a position to talk about, the way Larry is trying to encapsulate the real into the symbolic structures he knows, that is Judaism and physics, the same way the viewer is trying to understand the movie via traditional interpretations of movies. And thank you so much for that question and thought. So yeah, so what do we think about that? The idea that there's this real and symbolic relationship and Larry is unable to interpret or understand the real via his dual symbolic structures of Judaism and physics.
First of all, I love the fact that you say that you are not in a position to talk about Lacan, and then you do, because
I know, it's so good.
That's actually very Lacanian and very Zizekian, so that's fan-fucking-tastic, so thank you for that. I actually really like what you said, that maybe there is a sense, it's kind of like a formal take on the film, that we are expecting that a film is going to give us a resolution, that we're expecting that a film is going to kind of create characters, that we understand why they're in the situation in which they're in and what drives them and motivates them, and then how that connects with, if there is a prologue, which in this film there is, that somehow that's giving us ammunition to help us interpret the rest of the film, but that really we don't get much that we can hold on to, which then really seems to echo the themes that we talked about, which are kind of cosmic absurdity, there is no meaning, if we're alone in the universe, what is that? How does that frame how we ask the questions that we ask, and maybe there are no answers? I think that's really good. And if that's the case, and the Coen brothers did that intentionally, like if they sat down and said, the designing principle of this film is going to be this, then they're even fucking smarter than I already think they are, and that's fucking brilliant.
Yeah, and I think even from a Lacanian perspective, to be a little reckless with it, I mean, there's something to be said that we see Larry trying to, via, you know, diagrammatic schemas, make sense of reality. That's what he's doing as a physics professor. He's using numbers and visuals to try to map out how reality works to make it a comprehensive structure. And the real just says, nah, I'm good.
Can't do that.
You know, like, yeah, and even like, you know, there's this point where I'm going to get real reckless here. It's like we have Cy Abelman representing this weird version of the real in Larry's dream, where he's giving his lecture on his huge board and Cy Abelman is in class and he's like, you know, it's elegant, it's convincing, blah, blah, blah. But he gets all in his face and then says he's fucking his wife.
And then slams his head into the board a few times, because that's what the real does. The real just slams your fucking face into the wall over and over
again. It does.
Again.
There's a recklessness in reality. So I think that's a great question. Keep that up.
Sorry,
go ahead. No, you go.
I was just going to add that I think that I wasn't on that podcast with you guys, but A Serious Man to me is like a troll by the Coen brothers. And it came out, I think, notably right after Burn After Reading, which is also a troll of a movie, where I think that they went through this little phase where they're just like, we know, you know, people have expectations for just how stories should go, and we just want to say fuck all that and, have no resolution, no real reason for why these things kind of happened. And then at least in The Serious Man, that's kind of what the theme of the movie is. And like, that's what it's about, is the randomness of life, you know. But Burn After Reading, they don't really set that up for you. When you watch that movie the first time, you're kind of like, wait, what? You know, and then at the end, the CIA agent is just like, wait, what the fuck did we just learn here? You know, like that is, you know, they're trolling us. And I also think Ballad of Buster Scruggs is that to a degree with some of those, some of their shorts in their most recent one.
Oh, definitely.
So, yeah, I think that, sometimes the Coen brothers, they just say, you know what, we're going to just fuck with our audience in this movie. And then and that's what A Serious Man is to me.
So the Coen brothers are the only good trolls. I like that. So we have another email about this from Sean. And this is a great email. There's a lot in here. Only going to get to a little bit of it, Sean, but there's so many great ideas. So thank you for this. So something Sean brings up. He says, all through the movie, Larry is questioning why bad things are happening to him, even though he has done nothing to deserve it. But we as the audience can see that it is exactly his inaction and inattentiveness which is usually causing his misfortune. At the end of the movie, of course, his fortunes seem to begin to change as he gets tenure. At this point, he then takes the bribe, his first real decisive action, which is followed by what is likely his worst misfortune of the entire film, when he gets a call from his doctor. We presume there's cancer. And Sean says this can be interpreted in a few ways, but here are two that he wants us to consider. One is, this punctuates the idea that there really is no point to anything. His inaction wasn't always his misfortune. Nothing you do matters. There is no meaning. Stop looking. That's option one. Or two, Sean brings up, if you stay with the parallels of this versus the book of Job, you could say that unlike Job, Larry's faith has finally been shaken. The wager has been concluded. Larry has failed. When Job succeeds in his test, he's rewarded with good health and beautiful daughters. Larry's health and son are both taken from him. Interested in hearing your thoughts. That's from Sean.
Ew.
Thank you, Sean.
Yeah. Fuck.
And he, I know that's, and that's, I was like, oh, it's really good. So does anyone have a preference here or a take on the two options Sean gives us for how Larry's one moment of action in that film leads to misfortune?
Well, it's interesting to think about this in relation to what we were just talking about regarding courage in the war film, right? Like, he is 100% not courageous, because in order to be courageous, either in the ancient sense, like in the virtuous sense, or in maybe this potentially other sense of kind of like being thrown into an impossible situation, but still overcoming that situation, committing yourself to the cause. He doesn't do that at all. He kind of is just like a leaf blowing in the wind, allowing anxiety to dictate who he is and how he's going to be. And he's a very sort of weak figure because of that, right? So there's no courage whatsoever in Larry, in his inaction. And maybe that's the punishment, precisely because he refuses to commit himself to either the chaos or to being a virtuous, kind of courageous figure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I really like both of those options. I think to Sean's two options, have historically read it via that more simple nihilistic read where nothing you do matters anyways. But the Job stuff's interesting. I'm less familiar with the book of Job. It's been a while since I read that, but I think whether or not that's what the Coens intended, because of course Ryan just had his great theory that I like about the Coens as trolls, I think that's a really interesting interpretation. One more Serious Man question, and this one's kind of a little more fun. Anthony wrote in and got into how we discussed the suburban nature of A Serious Man, the way in which, I think, Austin, you might have brought this up, how it was a sort of ode or critique or reflecting on the cultural void that is the suburbs. And once again, most of us are suburban, so no judgment. Ryan, did you grow up in the suburbs?
Right out, kind of. Not really.
Okay.
Kind
but
of.
But you didn't grow up in a city.
No,
right?
I didn't, no.
Okay, cool. So none of us are snobby city folk. Let us tell you that. but Anthony reflected on this as well and then asked this question, how would this movie change if it were set in a city or a rural environment? Would it be as good and make its point as well? I think it's an interesting thought experiment. So any ideas on how A Serious Man would change or make a different point if it were set either in, let's say, New York or if it were set in, you know, the farmlands of Montana?
Oh, my gosh. Do you think he'd be even more pathetic if it was in New York? Because New York is so alive and so active and so... Not violent in a bad sense, but so aggressive that if
I mean,
you
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
If he's in New York, I mean, isn't like Uncut Gems kind of a version of this in New York?
Dude, I literally was thinking that. I was kind of is Uncut Gems maybe what this film would be?
Yeah. My other thought would be if it was rural, then nature would be involved in a really heavy way. I could see a version of this movie that's more, rather than someone struggling with the mundanity of suburban life, someone struggling maybe to find meaning and purpose in nature or responding to a natural disaster or something like that. But yeah, I think if it's in the city, it becomes more of a straight up comedy because I don't know how Larry keeps up. Ryan, any thoughts on A Serious Man in a Different Environment?
Well, I mean, it's worth noting that this is literally like from their childhood, you know, so like they're from the Midwest and so this is like a Midwest suburb, you know, the Jewish community.
Oh yeah,
there.
It's meant to literally be their Jewish suburb from Minneapolis they grew up in.
Yeah. So like, you know, it's kind of a obviously absurd question. I think it would totally change it.
It's a fun one though. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it'd be a little bit more similar if you did it to the rural one, cause it's, you know, it is about a small town and I assume, you know, a rural neighbor, community is even smaller, more closely knit. But rural,
I mean,
Jewish,
I'm gonna say
Orthodox communities. What were you going to say?
No, I'm going to say I think it would be fundamentally different because I do think there's something integral about the malaise of middle-class suburban life that this film is exploring. That doesn't mean that there aren't anxieties that exist in the city, but they're very different. People are on top of people. Class relations are far more protracted because you have greater differentiations between different divisions of where people are in their social and economic status. So I think it's very, very different just in its ethos, in its world, right? And I do want to just give a quick shout out, and I know Michael loves this author as well, but there's a guy named Lars Eier who we actually just did an interview on Owls at Dawn, which you guys know because I've talked about it a billion times. But Lars is a novelist / philosopher, and he wrote a book recently called Nietzsche in the Burbs. And I just want to encourage everybody to go get this book. It is very similar in tone to A Serious Man in the fact that's like pending doom is facing us, right? The book references Melancholia a lot, the film, the Lars von Trier film. And at the same time, it's about these teenagers growing up in the burbs and what is it like to grow up as a suburban youth facing issues of climate change and economic destruction, but also just the blasé, nothing ever happens in the suburbs. And what does that kind of produce? And I think there's some really interesting like philosophical and conceptual things to really work through that this film also touches on, but I think it's very explicitly suburban and it's almost like very particularly suburban.
I will second Austin's reading recommendation, but also say Lars's first set of books, which is a trilogy called Spurious Dogma and Exodus, is my favorite set of books ever. Everyone should read those too. Maybe we can have a book club about them sometime.
Oh shit.
But that was great. I'm just gonna real quick, these aren't really questions, but I just want to thank Maxwell, who did some sort of research about the bar mitzvah and some Rabbi Marshak stuff that I really dug, and it posited that maybe when Larry can't talk to Rabbi Marshak because he's thinking, he's actually thinking about the Jefferson Airplane song, which I think is funny and a fun idea. And then there's Justin did some really fun sleuthing here, and Justin, who's a white suburban Minnesota male of Yiddish descent, so he gets this world, brought up the point that when the Korean father, when Clive's father is kind of threatening Larry in the parking lot, when the goy neighbor comes and says, "Is this man bothering you?" If you follow his sight line, he's actually talking to the Korean father, implying that Larry's the troublemaker. And he sent a link to the clip. So I just thought that was a really cool catch. Who knows if that's what they were intending or not, but I thought that was a really cool find. So I wanted to thank those two for doing that. And then I'd say, while I would love to have tons of questions and comments about 1917, if anyone does have a pitch on the suburban or the urban version of A Serious Man, hit us up. And once again, voicemail 1213-534-8807, email